This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS Radio every Tuesday night at 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time or by going to our website at www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can also listen to live shows or to our past shows on our iPod Ready archive section. That's thepeoplespeakradio.net. And if you have a Nokia phone, you can also listen live via satellite. Just go to the website for details. We've got a wonderful guest with us tonight. Kiala Kelly is a journalist and filmmaker. We're going to be discussing a lot about her film, and I'm hoping I'm pronouncing this correctly, Noho Hiwa. That's probably wrong. Go ahead, please, Kiala, correct me.
Aloha, Basma. It's Noho Hiwa.
Hiwa, okay. Very nice to know that. Thank you. And that is the wrongful occupation of Hawaii. Kiala's work as a journalist and filmmaker on this particular issue primarily focuses on Hawaiian politics and cultural issues surrounding the indigenous peoples and the environment. Welcome to the show, Kiala. It's wonderful having you with us.
Well, aloha, and it's wonderful to be on this show. It's a great show, so it's my honor.
And for those of you that don't know, we're going into our fifth year. Can you believe it, folks? 5 years doing this. This is incredible, so we're very proud to have you with us. The wrongful occupation of Hawaii. I'm going to read this little bio of the film, is an emotionally raw portrayal of issues that shape the political, economic, and cultural world of Hawaiians. The film provides a contemporary look at the impact of militarism, tourism, and real estate, making critical links between these seemingly unrelated industries via their collective power to force Hawaiians out of their homeland economically, politically, and culturally. It frames desecration of Hawaiian burials and sacred sites as an intentional tool deployed by the American system and questions the role settlers play in the dispossession of the Hawaiian people and the disruption of their inherent sovereignty. Let me ask you, Anne, let's please, if you don't mind, start with some of the basics. I'm not sure how many really understand the nature of what's happening. Why do you call this, first of all, the wrongful occupation of Hawaii?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's exactly, by the way, the words Noho Hiwa translate to mean that, if it's going to be translated into English. And it's got a number of different meanings, because there are certain things about Hawaii and the history of Hawaii that most Americans, I would say, most people in the world, are completely unaware of. So when we talk about occupation here, and I call the film The Wrongful Occupation of Hawaii, that's to let people know that Hawaiians are looking at this as an occupation. Hawaiians more and more are becoming more educated and clear about the historical reality and the legal reality of the U.S. presence in Hawaii. Now, one of the things people don't typically understand about Hawaii is that back in the 19th century, and this is after, you know, Hawaiians have been in Hawaii for thousands of years, but in the 19th century, the Hawaiian people came under one government, and it was known as the Hawaiian Kingdom. And it was after all of the islands had been united, it became known as the Hawaiian Kingdom. And in the mid-19th century, that was recognized as a part of the family of nations. What was developing as international law back in that time of history, and the U.S. and European powers, they developed this organization called the Family of Nations. So Hawaii, to my knowledge, it was the first non-Caucasian country admitted into the Family of Nations and recognized as a nation state, so, or what was then considered a nation state. So we have this very different kind of history here, because we have this history of having developed a government that was a monarchy that was modeled after a European model of governing. And we also have this history of being the indigenous people of this place, the first people of this place, known as, in the Hawaiian language, we're called Kanaka Maoli or Kanaka O'iwi. So we have a really complicated history that we're dealing with here, even before the United States seized control of Hawaii in 1898. So when I say or anybody says the wrongful occupation of Hawaii, we're referring to two things. One, that it is an occupation, and two, that it's wrong, that Hawaiians did not consent, never agreed to be part of the United States. So we put those things together, and we call it HEVA.
So the HEVA will describe what the indigenous people or the majority of the indigenous people feel is their relationship to the United States of America.
Well, it's a generational thing at this point, right? This has been going on since, you know, the end of the 19th century. And 1898, let's be real about it, was a bad year for a lot of places, not just Hawaii. It was bad for the Philippines. It was bad for Puerto Rico because it was the United States Empire taking a big step out into the rest of the world. And it started here. And it planted its military here, and it's never left. So while Americans might not know that history, Hawaiians know it, and we know it more and more every day. We're becoming more and more educated on what actually did take place, because for us, in a lot of ways, the 20th century, most of the 20th century, was like the Dark Ages. I mean, you know, by the beginning of the 20th century, the Haole people who had taken control, the United States seized Hawaii, they outlawed the Hawaiian language. A lot of things went really bad for Hawaiians in the 20th century. It was a real brutalizing of Hawaiian culture. And so those of us who are involved in Hawaiian politics and culture, we know about these things, and we have to really work with those things and help whatever aspect of the culture that we're in. I mean, some people are teachers, some people are activists. I'm a filmmaker and a journalist. But we're all aware of what took place. And at this point in history, it's about us all having a very particular kind of dialogue about that.
Well, in order for us to join this dialogue, let me ask you, what exactly is the militarization of Hawaii? How does it impact or relate to events, as I was reading in some of the bios on you, to what's happening in the Middle East? First of all, how did it affect Hawaii? You're saying that they never left. And now how does it affect the Middle East and carry over into that aspect of the world?
Well, I would just sort of back up a little bit and try to say this another way. Every war that the United States has launched since the beginning of the 20th century has been launched out of Hawaii. So whether or not that's a war that's taken them to Europe, or a war that's taken them into Asia, or a war that's taken them into the Middle East, wherever the United States is warring, before it goes there to do war, it does war here first on our land, on our sacred sites. It practices to kill here in Hawaii. They will call this a militarily strategic location. That's what Hawaii is to the United States. But that's not what it is to the Hawaiian people, right? And it's not just what is the United States doing in the Middle East. It's what has the United States done all over the world. But what's important, I guess, for me as a Hawaiian person to try to get communicated from Hawaii out instead of from America in, is that America does war here before it does war any place else. And that's something that people don't usually consider when they think of war. They think of, you know, what's happening in Afghanistan or what's happened in Iraq or what's happened in other places, that's where the war is. But I would say that the war is here. Here's where they all come to train. Countless American soldiers have trained here and then shipped out. It's the largest military command in the world, Basima. So if you think about that, right, try to get your mind around what that means. Because Hawaii is very small. I mean, the island of Oahu is only about 640 square miles. Los Angeles County is like five times larger than Oahu. And yet Oahu...
And how much of a military presence did you say was there?
It is the largest military command on Earth, is on Oahu. And
wow.
Try to get people to understand what that means, right? It's a small place, but there's more military here than anywhere. It's huge concentration of military might on Oahu. So even if you think back the time of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, which the Hawaiian name for that place is Waimomi, by the way. It wasn't Pearl Harbor. Waimomi was an enormous fish pond that fed countless millions of Hawaiians for generations, right? Now it's a toilet. Now it's got 750 different toxic sites in it. It's a Superfund site, okay? So everywhere the military goes, it destroys it. It ruins whatever was there before it got there. But if you think back to when, during World War II and what happened here with the Japanese bombing the U.S. military sites at Pearl Harbor, it was already a large concentration of military might. That's what attracted Japan to bomb it in the first place. It wasn't that they were coming here to bomb Hawaiians. The military was already well established here by then. So it's hard to get people to understand that it's the largest military command in the world is located in Hawaii, because when people think of Hawaii, they think of a vacation, they think of something uncomplicated, something passive, something relaxing, hula dancers. They don't think of the terrible things that have happened here and are happening here, and they don't think of what happened to the Hawaiian people in order for those things to get to happen here, right?
Well, the other thing that I'd like to ask you is obviously the tourism factor. How has the tourism factor adversely affected the people of Hawaii?
Well, tourism, like militarism, takes up space, right?
Mm.
And like I said, we're talking about a very small place. I mean, this is the most isolated archipelago on Earth. This place is very small, and the resources are finite. So when you have a large military, you also have a large tourism industry. In fact, isn't that the history of America? Send in the military, you know, and then comes the settlers and whatever it is they want. You know, tourism in Hawaii is just an offshoot of militarism. And so, in fact, it especially became a huge tourist site during World War II and after World War II, because they needed to have some place for their military guys to R&R, right? So the industry itself is huge. In fact, militarism and tourism are the industries of Hawaii. These are the two largest industries of Hawaii. They control the entire economy of this place. So I know they're different industries, but they're linked, and both of them take up an incredible amount of space. Tourism isn't just limited to Waikiki. It's everywhere. So you have hotels everywhere. You have now, in the past 10 years, tourism has sort of morphed into this idea of being able to have your own vacation home in Hawaii. So it isn't like they're just staying in the hotels, right? They're out there having second and third homes. And they want these homes, by the way, in the most beautiful, pristine places. You know,
yeah. They
don't want to just have a home in urban Honolulu, right? They want to go down to the most beautiful beaches on Kauai, and they don't care if there's a burial ground there. They want their vacation homes there. So it becomes a systematic undoing and erasure of Hawaiians via these different industries, right? Because one guy might say, well, what's it matter if I have a vacation home in Hawaii? Who cares? I'm just one person. But they don't understand that, no, actually, they're one of millions of people that want that and try to achieve that. And we really don't have enough space and resources to accommodate for everybody. What ends up happening is the Hawaiians are forced out, because many Hawaiians can't assimilate into American culture and American economy. They don't think like Americans, and they won't think like Americans. We're different
here, and here in the United States, our image of the Hawaiians are that they are Americans. This is part
yes.
of America. They're Americans. We don't think of them at all of being a different culture. We just think of them as being, you know, Americans that do the hula. So fancy that. You know, let me ask you, you were talking about this dialogue. How is the dialogue coming to fruition? I know that, as you said, you're a filmmaker. I know that we have guests that are activists. And how does that play out in the Hawaiian community? Is this something that is starting to grow as far as the movement?
Well, historically, I mean, in terms of the modern sovereignty movement, which really started in the late 70s, and which, when I say, well, even earlier in the 70s, I'd say about 10 years after what we call fake statehood or the so-called statehood, 1959 was when the United States had a fake, fraudulent vote for statehood in Hawaii. It was totally fraudulent. Mm-hmm. And so it was by the end of the 60s, there was this movement that was starting up, and it's called the Hawaiian Sovereignty Movement. And back in the day, you know, actually, in fact, a lot of that movement kicked in when a handful of Hawaiian activists, young Hawaiian activists, tried to stop the bombing of the island called Koho'olawe. Much like people trying to stop the bombing on Vieques, these two things were almost identical. So the bombing of Koho'olawe and the protests that went on to stop that bombing really kicked off the modern sovereignty movement. I'd say in the 80s and into the mid-90s, that movement was really a call for political status for Hawaiians to become nation within a nation, native Hawaiians, almost very much like the American Indians.
I was just going to ask how you liken this to the situation here in the United States with the Native American Indians.
Yeah, I'd say that part of the sovereignty movement was modeled after that. They wanted to become recognized, and they wanted to have a land base, because that's always a problem for Hawaiians, is we don't have a land base. We don't have control over our own resources. So that movement, which was a huge movement, was mainly focused on gaining that kind of political status for Hawaiians. It failed. And here's the thing to understand about that, and hopefully your listeners will know who Senator Daniel Inouye is. He was the senator back then, and he's the senator now, and he's one of the most powerful men in the world. He certainly is one of the most powerful men in Washington, D.C. While he represents Hawaii, he did not make any moves to support that call for Hawaiians to become a nation within a nation. It's ironic that about 10 years ago, a piece of legislation that's now coming through the Congress as we speak came out of his office about 10 years ago that would create something that's sort of a pseudo federal recognition for Hawaiians. But back when Hawaiians were really calling to be federally recognized, that help wasn't there. And by the end of the 90s, that sovereignty movement morphed. It started to grow into an independence movement. And so the dialogue around Hawaiian politics, right now I would say it's split. Part of the community wants to be under the federal, you know, become a federally recognized group. The other part of the community wants to be independent from the United States completely, and they want to deoccupy. They want the United States out. So the kind of dialogue that's been going on, I'd say probably the past 12 years, has been more and more about independence.
Let me ask you, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Kalahui.
Uh-huh.
Is that similar to the sovereign nations of the Native Americans here in America? Is that the nation within a nation that you're referring to?
That was the group, Kalahui. That means the nation. That is exactly what it means. And Kalahui was the largest, and I mean, it still breaks the heart for a lot of us to look back on those days, because it looked really promising. Kalahui had tens of thousands of Hawaiians behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And the organization didn't end up being able to sustain itself for political reasons. I mean, there's always political reasons when you're in a political group or something's being politicized. But I'm inclined to look at the failure of Kalahui, not so much as a failure of the Hawaiian people, but as, like I said, Hawaiians starting to look more deeply at what it was that they were seeking, and really questioning why become a federally recognized tribe of the United States when you're not part of the United States, when you have this history of being your own country. Why even go there? And then this whole issue of occupation and deoccupation started to grow, especially since 2000. Ironically, the year that Senator Daniel Akaka introduced this legislation referred to as the Akaka Bill, which actually came out of Inouye's office, the same year that that happened was the same year that Keanu Tsai, who's now Dr. Keanu Tsai, who recently got his PhD, the same year that he and a small group of Hawaiians went to The Hague to argue about the independence of Hawaii. So the independence movement has really started to get stronger, but it's not really a movement in terms of like what you'd think you'd see on television, right? Like, you know, politics happen very differently in Hawaii than they do in other places, Hawaiian politics anyway. Mm-hmm. So we have a kind of different physical reality here, a different cultural reality. We, like I said, we are surrounded by the largest military command in the world. That's a heck of a thing to take on, whether you're going to argue deoccupation.
Pardon? I can imagine it would be, but let me ask you about this Akaka Bill. How, I know that you have mentioned it as far as like being, how it will potentially impact the indigenous Hawaiians. And a lot of people don't want anything to do with that. How, what do you think, is there, are there hidden portions of the bill itself that are probably very dangerous to the indigenous people's sovereignty?
Well, let me try to say this the best way that I can. This legislation, first of all, the actual name of it was changed to the Native Hawaiian Government Reorganization Act. It's a very long name. Most people aren't even going to try to say it. But it's referred to as the Akaka Bill because that was its original name.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing about that bill is that it's not hidden. It's very upfront and bold print in the bill. Its intention is to get Hawaiians to sign off on what's referred to as aboriginal title. That's like an international legal term.
Mm-hmm.
Aboriginal title to the land. Like, let me just talk about Alaska for a second. There are a whole bunch of Alaska Native tribes, right? There's, you know, I don't know, 50 or more. I don't know. There's lots of them, okay? And when the United States wanted to go in there and drill for oil, they created this thing called the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, referred to as ANCSA. And what that did was it gave a kind of pseudo-federal recognition. It was really like a corporate recognition of Alaska Natives. So Alaska Natives have all these corporations. Sometimes you'll read about it in the news. Well, an Alaska Native corporation does blah, blah, blah. Well, this all came out of ANCSA. But in order to get that recognition, that kind of recognition from the federal government, the Alaska Natives had to sign off on aboriginal title to Alaska. We're talking countless millions of acres here, right? Huge, huge amount of land. They had to sign off on aboriginal title, meaning they can't claim ownership of that land anymore. Even though they couldn't exercise their ownership before, now they can't claim it. So what's happening with the Akaka Bill is that it's modeled after ANCSA. So the point of the bill is to create this pseudo-federal recognition for Hawaiians, some Hawaiians, not all Hawaiians, and then let this fake entity that it then sets up sign off on Hawaiian title to all of the what's referred to as the ceded land or the Hawaiian Kingdom Crown and Government land of Hawaii. Let me just tell you real quick what that means. That's about half of the Hawaiian archipelago. So if this legislation
actually goes, it's 1.8 million acres of
well,
land.
Well, they haven't. Yeah, they haven't. Here's the thing: the state won't even get an accurate count of the land. They refuse to do an accurate count of how much we're really talking about. So oftentimes people will say it's 2 million acres, it's 1.5, you know. But it's safe to say that it's between 40 and 50% of the archipelago. even though the state won't give you an accurate count. They refuse to do it. So here we are in this tiny little place called Hawaii Mai, you know, the Hawaiian Kingdom, and it's way out here, 2,500 miles from California, and we have these finite resources. We already have this military problem. We have this tourism problem. We have this settler problem. The more settlers in Hawaii, the less Hawaiians in Hawaii. That seems to be, you know, the exchange. So if this legislation goes through, all of those things are going to increase. In fact, written into the legislation is that Hawaiians can't file land claims when this goes through. We can't go after the military for what the stuff it's done to the land. We can't do anything. We have to completely give a free pass to the United States. And in exchange, all we're going to get is some money and corporate status. It's the most sickening, revolting piece of legislation the United States has ever tried to shove down the throats of the Hawaiian people. And the only Hawaiians who are going along with it are the ones who are paid to go along with it. So it's really, it's so terrible that this legislation is still in motion, because it's really divided the Hawaiian community. We're fighting amongst each other.
That's what I understand. I understand that actually there's a widening rift that's occurred between them because of as a result of the formation of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. Why is that? I would think that the Office of Hawaiian Affairs to me sounds like this is the place to go when you're trying to figure out what the contention is. Why is there such a rift between the peoples because of this?
The Office of Hawaiian Affairs is a state agency. It's not a Hawaiian agency. And that's something just because it has the word Hawaiian in it doesn't mean it's Hawaiian. Because there's Hawaiians working in there doesn't mean it's a Hawaiian organization. So it works for the state. It's an agency of the state. It's spent millions of dollars lobbying Congress, members of Congress, to vote for this bill. It's been doing a lot of stuff. Now, in fairness to the Office of Hawaiian Affairs and the Hawaiians who work there, some of whom I know and really care very much for, they also do good work. You know, there's good stuff that the Office of Hawaiian Affairs does with the money that it gets. They do have some programs where they're trying to help Hawaiians. But when it comes to this piece of legislation, they're totally on the wrong side of it. They're on the side of the government. And so they're going to do the bidding of the government. And they know that this Hawaiian independence movement, they don't see it as a threat, because they think, well, nobody's ever heard of Hawaiian independence. You know, nobody's going to care about Hawaiian independence. What I would hope listeners would understand about this legislation, back to your original question about what it might do to the indigenous people of Hawaii, what I would hope that your listeners would try to get their minds around is that it isn't just about Hawaiians. What happens in Hawaii isn't just about Hawaiians, and it hasn't been for over 100 years. Because, like I said, every war the United States has waged, they've launched out of Hawaii. So what's happening here is being exported everywhere. People learn to kill here, and then they get on a boat or a plane, and they go somewhere, and they do that. So it isn't just Hawaii, Hawaiians that are going to suffer what happens with this Akaka bill. It's going to be the world. And let me tell you something else that's happening in Hawaii. We have the largest concentration of open-field genetically modified organisms on Earth. Again, it's a hard thing to get your mind around, but if you think about the genetically modified organisms industry, you think about corporations like Monsanto and Dow,
and the making of terminal seeds, is that some of what you're talking about?
That's the industry. The largest concentration of outdoor tests, open air testing of GMOs, is right here in Hawaii. This is where it's at. So we have everything happening to this small place that is having an effect on the rest of the world. So all of what's taking place in Hawaii with regard to the land, with regard to the Hawaiian people, I know that things are so racialized in America that people tend to think, that's not my problem. That's your problem. Well, you natives, so you got to go take care of that yourself. I would beg your audience to rethink that position, because it does affect you. It already has affected you. If there's ever, wherever you see the military, think Hawaii. Wherever you see the United States military, think of Hawaii. It already has had an effect on the planet. So I'm asking people to think about this legislation, think about what it can mean to a place like Hawaii, but also think about what it will mean to the world if these industries, tourism, militarism, genetically modified organism industry, if these industries are allowed to go unchecked in Hawaii, eventually it'll make its way out to the rest of the world. So it isn't just some isolated group of natives that have to deal with this. And if
Let
you think about
you.
It in terms... Mm-hmm.
What I was curious about is, do you have any non-Hawaiian support for these issues?
We have many non-Hawaiian allies in the movement. Absolutely. And I think all over the world. And I think the more people are educated about these issues, the more support Hawaiians have. Right now, you know, my concern, I guess, is, and you probably can hear it in my voice because I get very strange when I talk about something like the Akaka Bill. My concern is that this thing's going to happen, and it's going to happen so swiftly that it's going to be kind of irreversible. So it won't matter that we have people who actually support us. I mean, that's one of the things about the film. Actually, I should talk about that for a second. Noho Heva is a really important film. I'm not saying that because I made it, but because of the issues that it represents, and because it ties all of these things together in 80 short minutes, and helps people understand from the Hawaiian perspective what occupation means, what it means to have these GMOs here, these GMO companies here, what it means to have the largest military command. It helps people understand the local and the international implications of that. And I'm hoping that I can get the film out to as many people as possible so that as the Hawaiian independence movement progresses, at least as it moves forward, and it will move forward, it's not going to stop. It's only going to go forward. But I'm hoping that people will know about Hawaii so that when they hear about what's happening in Hawaii, it isn't like something they've never heard of. So that's one of the reasons that I made the film, was so that people can have a sense of the political urgency that surrounds these issues.
Well, and indeed, there is a great deal of urgency. And for those of you that would like to find out more about the film, Noho Heva, you can go to www.noho, that's N-O-H-O, Heva, it's HEWA.com. I would encourage you to go and the trailer is fantastic. The information there is fantastic. And I think people... need to be more aware of how, you know, one of the things that even in the short trailer, Kiala, I saw and witnessed was that the passion and the pain that some of these people were talking with, you know, it was just, it reminded me so much of so many indigenous peoples that have been displaced from their homelands, the Native Americans here in the United States, Palestinians, people all over the world, the Australian Aborigine, all fighting and struggling for not a redemption, but just, you know, I know that, let me ask you about this. This is, I think, something very important. Now, there's the Clinton created and passed the apology bill and acknowledged and apologized for the illegal overthrow of the Kingdom of Hawaii. How did that... But, you know, when you look at the bill itself, the heart of the bill lies in its expression of commitment to acknowledge the ramifications of Hawaii's illegal overthrow. So these ramifications are known by our government. They're known by our country. People know what happened and how it has affected the indigenous people. And, okay, so you apologized. And then what? Was there more to the apology bill that satisfied anyone at that point?
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, the apology bill is like throwing a wet blanket on that, you know, sovereignty movement I was talking about earlier. And as in, you know, as Haunani K. Trask famously said, they did not take an apology from us. We don't want an apology back. We don't need, you know, the big thing about this apology bill, or referred to as the apology resolution, or public laws 105-150, signed into law by President Bill Clinton in 1993, as you said. Mm-hmm. The good thing about that legislation, the only good thing about it, in my opinion anyway, is that rarely do you get the perpetrator of a crime to admit to the crime and then sign it into law, this admission of the crime. Rarely does that ever happen, especially with a country like America. They flat out admitted that they conducted the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom or helped these Haole businessmen do the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom, however you want to, you know, describe it. But the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom would never have taken place without the U.S. Involvement and without the them landing the Marines here in Honolulu. But that's pretty much the only good thing about the resolution, because a resolution, even though they'll sign it into law, if nobody's going to enforce anything, if there's no, you know, there was no land given back, it wasn't anything. It was just like, okay, you're right, we did it, we're sorry. But I'll tell you what did come out of that is the Akaka Bill. You know, less than 10 years later, they gave us the Akaka Bill. And some people, in terms of the analysis that people give to that, they say the Akaka Bill is just the United States trying to get Hawaiians to, you know, forget about the apology bill. You know, what Hawaiians need to understand is that the perpetrator went on the record, said that it committed a crime, and that's all we need. We just need to move forward from there. But Congress is not, they're not going to go gently, right? So they came up with an Akaka Bill. Senator Inouye came up with an Akaka Bill and then put in put the Hawaiian senator's name on it. So,
It made it more plausible. Is that what they're doing, just by putting a Hawaiian senator's name on it? It made it more
Senator Akaka, I mean, these things aren't, none of this legislation's ever written in a vacuum, right? So although it was initiated in Inouye's office, Senator Akaka has been fronting for that bill since it came out. He's proud to do that. He's a very proud American. You can't be a Hawaiian nationalist and an American nationalist at the same time. You're one or the other, right? You can't be for Hawaiian independence and for an Akaka Bill. So he's very pro-American, you know, the senator's in his 80s. He's proud to be American. He's proud of this legislation. Personally, that's not my issue, you know, except that it's a really bad piece of legislation. But it's important to understand that it really just came, it came out like 7 years after the apology resolution.
Yeah, very. So, you know, we've got a number of questions from our listeners, but I'd like to talk to you briefly about, you know, I still remember when I was a child. I was born in 52, so in 1959 I was in elementary school, and all of a sudden there was another state. There was another state. Nobody knew. I never knew how it got there. And as a matter of fact, I would forget it. During my early years in school, because it never was, and then it was. And one of the reasons probably was because they didn't want a lot of people to know that the majority of Hawaiians didn't even vote.
Right.
During that time that, you know, this great celebratory attainment of statehood came about, nobody even voted for it. And there it was, a state. So I found that to be, extremely interesting as I was looking into all of these issues that we're talking about now. But we've got a couple of questions that I'd like to try to get in here if we can. Mike in California. Please, go right ahead, please.
Let me just say something about that, what you're saying about, you know, one day there was another state.
Yeah, it just appeared.
Yeah, I think that a lot of Hawaiians felt that way too and still do. The thing about the statehood vote that is the reason we call it the fraudulent statehood vote or the, you know, fake statehood, because this is the 50th anniversary, 2009, of the fraudulent statehood vote, or rather admission. And the reason that we call it fraudulent, and I hope somebody from the United Nations is listening, I hope it makes a difference. The reason it's fraudulent is because on the ballot, the only thing it's fraudulent for a few reasons, but on the ballot, the only choices that we're given to vote on are A, become a state, or B, remain a territory of the United States. Those were the only choices. Under international law, there are two other choices that were supposed to be on that ballot. One of those other choices is to have free association, like what the Micronesians have with the United States. And the other one was for independence, which for us would have meant reinstatement of the kingdom. Independence. That was left off of the ballot. That's why it wasn't taken seriously, because it was a fraudulent ballot to begin with. In addition to that, anybody who was here got to vote. It wasn't Hawaiians voting. So all the guys in the military got to vote. Probably they were even letting visitors vote. Anybody could vote. So here they are flying in and busing in all these other people who have nothing to do with what happened 60 years earlier. And by the way, there were plenty of Hawaiians alive at that time who remembered the kingdom, who were citizens of the kingdom, who remembered our queen. So it's not ancient history to us. It wasn't ancient history in 1959, and it's not ancient history in 2009. This is very real to us. So that's probably why a lot of Hawaiians did not take it seriously, because it wasn't even valid.
You know, as I listen to you, Kiali, I think so often the similarities between the Palestinian struggle and this, because the same thing happened during the Balfour Proclamation when the Arabs at the time, the indigenous Palestinians, decided not to sign the Balfour, and accept the Balfour Proclamation because they thought it was ridiculous. But at that time, what they didn't know was they were signing their own demise. Well, they were not signing their own demise by not signing.
That was what was in the works. Yeah,
it was the same. It was very similar situation. And so they just kind of ignored it, thinking, well, we're not going to sign any of this. This is ridiculous. They're giving our land to another people while we're living in it. That doesn't even make any sense. So they ignored it, basically. And obviously, no, we know what happened after that. And no, the United Nations doesn't care, I don't think. Just in case you were wondering.
I don't think they care. Well, here's the other little known factoid that Americans can take in, hopefully. Even though Hawaii was and still is its own country, it's occupied. After World War II, Hawaii was on the list of non-self-governing territories to be decolonized. Mm-hmm. So this whole thing of statehood, that's another reason why we think of it as fraudulent. They rushed that thing through because in 1960, the United Nations started to decolonize all these different places in the world that have been held under colonial empires, you know, from Jamaica to, the South Pacific, you know. So there's all kinds of places that were decolonized after World War II, and Hawaii was actually on that list, even though it wasn't a colonial, quote-unquote, colonial territory under international law. It was on the list of territories to be decolonized. So the world was well aware of what had happened to Hawaii because, like I said, in 1959, it wasn't ancient history. The queen died in 1917. So this is not ancient history to us, and it wasn't ancient history to anybody watching it. So, yes, the United Nations doesn't care because they stood there and watched that fraudulent thing take place, and they did nothing to intervene.
Unbelievable. Just unbelievable. Yeah, very, very, as I said, there are so many similarities. And, you know, over and over and over again, every time I hear a story of an indigenous takeover of land, I hear the same things, the same outcry, the same racism that they experience, the same degradation, the same poverty levels that they achieve while their own countries are progressing, and nobody knows why. Well, we know why. Mike in California asked, do you feel that Hawaiians are as oppressed as the natives in the USA and just as victimized?
Well, I'm not sure which aspect of Native oppression and victimization in America Mike's referring to. The histories are different. Okay, first of all, let me say this. White supremacy, you know, that's the foundation of America, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The removal, the murder, the genocide of as many indigenous people and nations, the end of those nations, as the white people get their hands on, right?
Mm-hmm.
In addition to that, the enslavement of countless millions Africans, natives to Africa, the indigenous people of the African continent, who were kidnapped, mm-hmm. tortured, enslaved, and forced to build a country for hundreds of years. Okay? So that is the America that I always am thinking about. Okay? It's not glossed over in my mind what's happened in America. Yes, there have been many people oppressed in America. But what's happened to the first people of that continent and the kidnapped Africans who have been made to live on that continent, a whole other level of inhumanity, a whole other degree of white supremacy. So in that kind of a question, I have to say it's always different, because the thing about white supremacy is it doesn't mind reshaping itself for each particular group or each particular geographic location, right? The white supremacist mind doesn't mind waiting 100 years to take your land, because they'll just hand it on to the next generation of white supremacists. So it's a different kind of oppression in Hawaii. What happened to the Hawaiians in the 19th century, very similar to what happened to the natives of the continent in terms of the diseases that were introduced. Hawaiians to this day still think of those things as intentionally being introduced. In less than 100 years, 90% of our population was killed off. 90%. That's a lot of people to see dying right before your eyes. We were a healthy, strong population before white people came here. There were anywhere from 500,000 to 1 million Hawaiians living and thriving in Hawaii before the Western world showed up. And those Hawaiians, they were 7 feet tall. These were big, strong people. So when the Westerners brought their religion, their culture, their opala,
their diseases,
smallpox, their sicknesses, and they knowingly let, and from the moment Captain Cook arrived and his men infected Hawaiian women with sexually transmitted diseases, they knew what they were doing. He knew he was unleashing syphilis on Hawaiians. He had already seen what syphilis had done to the Tahitians and to other, mm-hmm. other Pacific Islanders. So they knew. So we never look at this stuff as being some kind of accident. White people might want us to think it was an accident. It's not an accident. That's like having AIDS and going out and having sex with people. And you know it's going to kill them. It's the same thing, except it was done en masse. So in terms of what's happened in the 20th century to Hawaiians, in terms of depression, oppression and dispossession, the systematic way that it's done to Hawaiians is a little different than the way it was done to the Indians. But the outcome, or the desired outcome, isn't different. The agenda isn't different. It just plays out differently because it's a different cultural reality. It's a different political reality, but it's still America uninvited, stealing, destroying, and rendering this place unlivable for the people who are of this place.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Mike in Australia would like to ask, let's try to keep this straight. It's a lengthy question. I read some time ago that the U.S. business interests got a U.S. gunboat to shell the Royal Palace in Hawaii in 1898 to force the issue of U.S. interests being paramount. This resulted in the death of three people, including the Japanese ambassador, who was the uncle of Emperor Hirohito. This is one of the primary reasons that Hawaii was attacked in World War II, yet I can't find any book or any information on the attack on the Internet. Did this happen?
You know, I wish I could answer that. I have not heard of this incident, but I would want to suggest that Mike in Australia send an email, and I hope Kamisai doesn't mind I'm about to do this, but I'm going to. should send an email to Tianu Sai, who knows, who has so much of that history at the, you know, tip of his fingers. I mean, he can name every kind of incident that ever happened. And his email is, for the world to hear, it's anu@hawaii.edu. ANU at hawaii.edu. And that's Keanu Sai. Or you can just Google Keanu Sai send him that question. I think he'd be happy to hear from Mike in Australia.
Well, there we go.
And by the way, I don't know if Keanu knows that I'm on the radio today, but, you know, I guess he'll get an email.
I guess he'll find out from Mike. We have a question from Ed in Canada. In the event of Hawaiian independence, would there be a move to cleanse the foreign residents?
You mean, like, I guess you're, like, referring to what's happened in Africa and certain places in Africa, like Zimbabwe?
I would assume. The people that have condos and homes in the area that are not full-time citizens of Hawaii.
Right. Well, you know, Ed and others who may have that question, I have two things I'd like to say about that. First of all, that's the least of my problems, and that's the least of any Hawaiian's problems. Hawaiians don't go around thinking like that. You know, we're trying to stop something from getting worse. And it's really frustrating when people kind of jump to this other far-reaching end that is so far down the list of things to consider, you can't even see it with binoculars, right? So it's like that's really kind of a non-question, and it's almost like a fear or scare tactic kind of question. It's like saying, well, we can't support Hawaiian independence because then all these people who live there are going to have to leave. I mean, it's like, you know, that kind of thinking. I think the world could do without that kind of thinking, and I don't mean to insult Ed in Canada, but we need to think differently. When somebody like me or any Hawaiian is talking about Hawaiian independence and what Hawaiians are going through as this independence dialogue is happening and the kind of removal that's going on of Hawaiians through these industries, right? We're not thinking about stuff like that. We're thinking about pono. We're thinking about how do you bring righteousness? How do you bring justice? How do you bring aloha to a situation that is void of love, that is void of humanity? So I don't ever think about that kind of an issue. I've had a lot of white people ask me that question, and I always say to them, why do you think we would do what you have done? Why do white people think like that? That Hawaiians would do to them what's been done to Hawaiians. I don't know one Hawaiian and never have known one Hawaiian in my whole life. Well, okay, one. I can say there's one. But it's not a relative. But
don't name
Hawaiian.
Him.
Give his email address away. But most Hawaiians don't even think like that because we are ethnically diverse. My father was Irish. We are a very ethnically diverse people. We are genealogically Hawaiian, but we have other ethnicities and ancestry. Hawaiians don't think in terms of evicting people. It's other people evicting us. So it's kind of like this fear thing that comes along with that sort of a question, I think.
Yeah, very, very interesting. You're right, and I know exactly what you're saying. Again, I've often been asked, how do you feel about the possible takeover by the Muslim community in Palestine? I says, I really am not worried about it. I says, right now we're worried about the ones that are taking over as we speak. You know, I'll worry about that problem when it comes up.
When it comes up, it's like, you know, the settler problem in Palestine or the settler problem in Hawaii. That's the problem. It's not what happens
exactly.
With people being settled on finally get to catch their breath. Right.
Exactly. Eric in Iowa has a twofold question. Actually, he's got two questions here, but I'm going to put them together. His first question is it possible for Hawaii to secede from the union legally? And his follow-up question is, why has Hawaii waited so long to vote on secession?
Well, there are people who would answer this question in many different ways, but I'll tell you the way I answer it. First of all, you have to actually be a part of the United States to attempt secession. If we're talking about an illegal occupation, we're not talking about seceding. We're talking about deoccupying. So that's not, I never think about it in terms of secession. Because if it was a secessionist movement, it would be not about Hawaiians. It would be about, you know, everybody here, right? It would be them doing it, like Vermont, right? You know, those wild people up there in that part of America. But you know, that's a secessionist movement up there, but in Hawaii, we're not talking about seceding, we're talking about deoccupying and reinstating our own leadership so that we can make decisions about our own government, right?
Yeah, I understand that fully. We've got one more question. Let's see if we can get in before we have to close out for the evening, folks. Lauren in Florida asks, does the guest think that Obama will be sympathetic to her cause or simply act as a politician in service of the corporate capitalist America?
God bless Lauren in Florida for asking that question, because I forgot to say this. Barack Obama, although is from Hawaii, he does not really have any sympathy for the Hawaiian cause, and he has married himself to the Akaka bill. So that was part of what he was saying before he even got elected. He's the president of the United States, not of the Hawaiian cause. He is going to sign that bill into law, and so I would ask your listeners to all send him an email, send him a letter, and tell President Obama that Hawaiians don't want this legislation. Hawaiians are still having their own political conversation, their own dialogue. And it's a dialogue that needs to go on uninterrupted, without government interruption and without corporate interruption. It's a dialogue Hawaiians need to have without the United States. But no, Barack Obama is not sympathetic to the Hawaiian cause. He's sympathetic to the American cause in Hawaii.
That's wonderful. You know, there you have just been a wealth of information, Kiala. I really appreciate having you with us. And perhaps as we follow these paths that indigenous people are following to some kind of freedom and sovereignty in their lives, we can include you as a friend and have you back later on to see how your life in Hawaii has developed. And for those of you that don't know, again, nohaheva.com. It's an excellent documentary, and I highly recommend it to everybody. Next week, Paul Peterson, our guest, child star of the Donna Reed Show, speaks about child star advocacy. We'll see you soon. And thank you, Kiala, very much. What an incredible interview. Thank you.
Mahalo nui, Pasima. It's a pleasure and an honor.
Thank you, Fox. That's it. Let the people speak.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea, by the relief of fast, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.